sure as God made green apples, someday the Chicago Cubs are going to be in a World Series.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series!
You are Locked On Cubs, your daily Chicago Cubs podcast.
But we didn't come here to drink beer! We came here to win this ballgame!
Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
I said to the Uber boy, I said, take me out with the crowd!
What's going on, Cubs fans? You're listening to Locked On Cubs, part of the Locked On Network, your team every day. On today's episode, you're joined with myself, Sean Sears, of course. I'm your host, with Ryan Davis on today's episode as we kind of we jump into a little bit of the John Schiambi hire, what that means for the Cubs, and if we're fans of it or not. You know, spoiler alert, Ryan and I don't mind Schiambi. It's a little weird that a guy's name, grown man's name is Boog, but her nickname is, but it, beyond that, seems like a good hire. We dive into that as well as talking through Zach Davies. Ryan wrote an interesting article about the Cubs acquiring him back around January 1st, but we're circling back a little bit just to kind of jump into Davies and dive into his numbers a little bit because if you hadn't been trading Yu Darvish for Zach Davies, that'd be a pretty cool pickup. But you did, so it's kind of a bummer. But Davies still has value, and he could be a guy that the Cubs maybe see for the future, or maybe someone they could package in a deal this year at the deadline. So there's a lot of versatility there, but a good pitcher and a guy that gives you pretty solid changeup. So we'll dive into that along with what his impact could be in this rotation, you know, short-term, long-term. And then we also talk a little bit about Derek Gould from the St. Louis Dispatch. He has a very interesting Hall of Fame ballot that Ryan and I talk about. He actually wrote about for Cubs Insider. So that's what we got here on today's episode. It's brought to you by BuiltBar.com. Head to Built Bar to get some of the best tasting protein bars you guys will ever have and use promo code LOCKEDON to get yourself 20% off your next order. That's BuiltBar.com, Locked On as the promo code. Make sure you subscribe to us on whatever podcast app you use, whether that's Google, Apple, Spotify, TuneIn app, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcast, subscribe, leave a 5-star review. And make sure you follow us on Twitter at Lockdown Cubs. Follow me on Twitter at Sean R. Sears. And you can follow Ryan on Twitter at Ryan Q. Davis. But with that, here is our conversation with Ryan Davis. Are we ready for some football? College football heads into a bowl season, and there are some big matchups this weekend. NFL regular season is finishing up with the playoff picture becoming clear. There's only one place that has you covered, and the one place we trust. That's betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code LOCKEDON for your 50% welcome bonus. But with NFL games coming up, obviously tons of college football. We've got NBA starting officially. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action. Don't forget to use promo code LOCKEDON to receive 50% off on your welcome bonus with your first deposit. That's BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Visit our good friends and exclusive partners at BetOnline_AG on social media to take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Sign up for a free account and use promo code LOCKEDON when you sign up for your bonus. Hey guys, Sean Sears here from Locked On Cubs to talk to you guys about Built Bar. Built Bar is one of the best tasting protein bars I've ever had. I know I talk to you guys about this all the time, but Built Bar is not only one of the best tasting protein bars with flavors like caramel brownie, cookies and cream, lemon almond cheesecake. It's a new one I've been trying. Those are all new flavors, but they've got their original flavors too, like peanut butter, banana bread, mint brownie. I love mint brownie. That's been my breakfast of choice the last couple months now. But the bars are 100% covered in chocolate, super easy to chew, soft. But the best thing about them is they're healthy. They're great for the health conscious guy, losing weight, whether that's losing, maintaining weight. It's a nice treat to indulge yourself with. They're low calorie, low sugar, high fiber, high protein. It's great for the keto diet if you're trying to lose weight during quarantine here right now. But take, for instance, the cherry Baraka. 17 grams of protein, 130 calories, 4 grams of sugar, 4 grams of net carbs. That is incredibly healthy for you, is good for you, obviously, but also tastes really good. It's a nice snack to have throughout the day. It's better than me chewing on, like, I don't know, a donut. I'm a big fan of Goldfish and chips and crackers. It's nice to be able to just eat one of these protein bars. I'm relatively full. I don't snack throughout the day, and I'm ready to eat dinner later on in the day. It's nice. I don't spoil my meal, and my girlfriend doesn't get mad at me when I don't want to eat the dinner she just made. But Built Bar has the promo code Locked On to get yourself 20% off your next order. So you head to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code Locked On. You save yourself 20% off your next order of Built Bars. They're delicious. They're nutritious. They're easy to bring anywhere on the go. Great snack for work from home. head to BuiltBar.com, use promo code LOCKDOWN, save yourself 20% off, and give these guys a shout out. They've been doing awesome work for the Lockdown Network and are making some of the best protein bars you'll ever have. What's going on, Cubs fans? Joined with me today is Ryan Davis as we touch on just kind of some news updates that have happened throughout here. John Schiombi sounds like he's going to be the replacement to Len Casper. We did have somewhat of a signing, a minor league deal for the Cubs. And then Ryan and I are also going to be talking about Zach Davies today and where he fits into this Cubs rotation depth, if you can call it that. But before we do that, Ryan, how's it going today?
Oh, you know, other than some hiccups with the internet as we tried to get the podcast off the ground, I guess it felt like we were the Cubs trying to build rotation depth starting our podcast today. It's just, you know, every one step forward, two steps backward, but we're moving along.
Yeah, at least we're recording and we're talking about things right now. That's a plus. But I guess is kind of news if we want to start it out here. The Cubs have picked a broadcaster, John Schiombi, obviously pretty familiar with some. I think most fans are familiar with him, at least if they've watched Baseball Tonight or watched any of the KBO broadcasts this year before the MLB kicked off. Schiombi was kind of that main guy. He's called other things for ESPN before, but it felt like a lot of people were really excited about this move. I personally don't mind John Schiombi. I'm not a I wasn't necessarily super excited. Like, I think I saw Bleacher Nation say that they thought this was a perfect hire. And I mean, in my opinion, I don't think there was a perfect hire. He's with the White Sox right now, sadly. But what were your thoughts on this, Ryan, when you saw the news that what's his nickname again?
His nickname is Boog.
What'd you think of Boog?
I mentioned this before we started, and I'll tell the listeners. I just don't like calling a grown man Boog. It just seems, I don't know. It comes from Boog Powell, who's a baseball player who I guess, I don't know, maybe Schiombi was mistaken for him, I think.
I'm assuming. Yeah.
he said that he showed up the next day and his name tag didn't say John Schiombi, it said Boog Powell. So he said people have been calling him Boog since he was in his 20s. But anyway, I agree with you. There was no perfect hire unless you want to talk about the guy who's with the White Sox, which, you know, I'm a huge Jason Benetti fan too. So.
Yeah. It's so funny. But yeah, what were you saying?
I like this. I have no qualms with Schiombi. Marquis going for that national broadcast feel that we've talked about before. And this accomplishes that in a way that I don't think is offensive to our ears. In a way that, let's say, Chris Myers may have been.
Yeah.
So, and we probably still will get 30 games or so of Chris Myers, assuming the season is played in full. Because Schiombi is still going to have some ESPN duties to tend to throughout the season. So, you know, he seems like a guy who likes baseball and he has a really strong appreciation for Wrigley Field. I think he, like Len Casper, blends the new age discussion about analytics really well with just old school baseball. And in that way, I think, like Casper, he will mesh with Jim Deshaies really well in the booth. So I have no arguments with this. I've seen a lot of the takes have been, holy cow, Marquis got something right. The Cubs did, you know, they made a correct choice. I think the biggest takeaway is that keep being loud on social media about this team if you don't like some of the things that you're seeing, because somebody's listening. I remember that, you know, in the wake of the Len Casper news, there was the Chris Myers is going to take over rumor. Mm-hmm. And that was, there was a lot of social media reaction to that where people were like, whoa, no, thank you.
Yeah. No, thank you. It's probably not even as polite as they were about it.
Yeah. And then Crane Kenny was quickly out there saying, like, you know, that was just a rumor. That's not, you know, necessarily true. And the guy that we hire or whoever we hire will fit Cubs culture. And then he made sure to throw in the, we're not talking about ownership culture. So it was very much like, okay, what's that comment all about? You know,
yeah, like, felt very retcon.
Yeah, so it very clearly was like a, I promise we're listening to your complaints. We get it, which they don't most of the time. But in this case, it seems like they did listen. And you know, we're being a bit, I'm being a bit conspiratorious, I guess. Is that the word?
We'll use it.
About the whole Chris Myers thing. I have a feeling that that was either something they were planning to do, or they put it out there with Sahadev's story. And then I think a few others mentioned it early on, just to maybe test the temperature and see how people felt about that.
Yeah.
Regardless of what it was, I think in the end they probably got this right. So you don't, if you're able to watch Cubs baseball next year, which coin flip on whether you are, at least John Ciambi and Jim Deshaies with the flavor of the week, former player, third booth guy, and then Taylor McGregor, it's going to be what it is, but at least the play-by-play will be solid.
Yeah, exactly. Ciambi is solid. He seems like a guy that seems to get what Cubs baseball is about at least a little bit, and he obviously has a great appreciation for Wrigley. He said in one of the quotes, having the opportunity to come to Wrigley Field and call games for the Chicago Cubs every day is surreal. It really doesn't get better than that. Chicago is one of the best cities, and Wrigley's the best ballpark out there. So, awesome. And then there was a quote, or not a quote, there was a video that I saw with it was David Ross, Chipper Jones, and Boog in the press box, talking about how, I guess, he Ciambi had asked Chipper Jones why he swings at first pitch strikes. So, like, he talked to him before the game, went up to the at bat, took the first pitch, it was a strike, and then he looked up at the booth, and it was just kind of like a funny moment. But it was nice to see, like, he obviously, like, knows what to bring to a broadcast to add that like extra level of texture, something that I think we really appreciated with Len. So it's great that they were able to find a guy who should be able to kind of blend both worlds a little bit with the players, the analytics, and just kind of making it baseball fun. So,
and the other aspect, I saw that video as well, and I thought it was really cool that, you know, we're talking about Chipper Jones, who's in the booth with Ciambi at this time, with also, you know, side note, David Ross. They're joking about it, but in the video where they show the flashback, you know, Chipper Jones is given like the fake glare up.
Yeah. He's like actually pissed. Yeah.
Cause you know, the whole thing is Ciambi says, you know, you're not having any luck on the first pitch. Why are you swinging all the time at it?
Right.
Chipper's response basically was like, that's the only chance I have at getting a fastball over the plate. And so he takes the first pitch, which is fastball over the middle at 91, and he ends up glaring up. And they're joking about it. And Ciambi mentions, you know, if you're going to blame me for that at bat, then, you know, we came back from 0-1 and we walked. But, like, seeing the rapport that he had with the players, not just while Chipper was in the broadcast booth, but enough that having that conversation with him while Chipper was still a player was enough to make Chipper Jones say, okay, I'll go up there and take the first pitch and we'll see what happens. Like, making it, you know, the fact that he trusts him enough to have that conversation about him and not just blow it off and say, well, you're not a player, you don't know what you're talking about, enough to say, okay, I'll see what he's talking about. I'll see if maybe, you know, maybe he's right that I shouldn't swing at this first pitch. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but it just seems like that's a guy that you want around your team, is a guy that the players have that kind of rapport with, that they have that with him. And you're going to have that between him and David Ross as the manager, which I think will translate into, you know, better production for Marquis. So, a good win all around, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But tough. I didn't see anyone who was super upset about this move. There were some people that were really excited. I didn't mind it. I like Ciambi. I wasn't like jumping through the roof or anything like that. But for a person to follow up Len Casper with, they picked a solid one. So I like him.
I'm sure Chip Carey's rooting section is really upset. I think there was a. I don't know if I said it on the podcast, but I know I said it other places that in the wake of the Len Casper stuff, my prediction was that Marquis would get it completely wrong and go back and get Chip Carey again, because, you know, Tom Ricketts's surveys that he sends out that nobody knows about he swears he's surveying the fans on. They all tell him what he wants to hear. I could swear that demographic that he's polling is probably all like, bring back Chip Carey. And sure enough, I saw on Twitter people saying, you know, in the comment section that it should be Chip Carey, and people voting in polls saying Chip Carey. So,
oh my God.
Thank you, Cubs, for not getting it wrong.
Yeah, geez. That would have been some fanfare for sure. well, yeah, it didn't happen, so I don't have to get upset about it. But we did have some transactional news a little bit. The Cubs did sign Adam Morgan to a minor league contract. I know we can touch on this for a second. You pointed out to me before the broadcast started that that Morgan was the guy that Jason Hayward hit the grand slam off of, the walk-off grand slam back in, was that 2017, 2018?
I think it was 2018. It was like right at the beginning of that like moment in Jason Hayward's Cubs career where everything before that was terrible.
Yeah.
And everything since then has been either replacement level or better. So like that was kind of like the Jason Hayward turning point that a lot of people point to. And it was also a big swing. The Cubs were losing. They had the bases loaded. I think it was two outs in the ninth with two strikes.
Yep.
Lefty on lefty with Hayward at the plate, the guy that you at that moment in time are just like, here comes the ground ball to second base.
Yeah.
But Hayward drills it for the grand slam and walks it off. What a great Jason Hayward memory in general, but I'm sure Adam Morgan doesn't appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm sure he doesn't. I want to touch on him in a second, but I do want to share a quick story about that game. Actually, my girlfriend actually went to that game and left early. And this is when we live we lived not even a block away from Wrigley Field. So like to use the excuse that we wanted to beat traffic is nonsense because we live 5 minutes away. Like even like traffic from the ballpark is going to take you 2 minutes. Like, come on.
Yeah. The difference between leaving early and staying to the end of that game might mean an extra 2 minutes crossing the road.
Right. Exactly. Like you just barely dodged all that. And like after a walk off when no one's leaving right away anyways,
like a perfect summer night too.
Yeah.
You're not talking about like rain or snow.
There was like no reason for them to leave this baseball game other than they just didn't care. And they went because they wanted to get drunk at a baseball game. And that's fine. But you left one of the coolest goddamn games ever. And what was amazing is like they walked in like maybe seconds after Hayward had hit the grand slam. And they opened the door and I'm sitting in my living room like freaking out. And they're like, oh, what happened? Did they lose? Are you upset? And I was like, what are you doing here? Like, give me your ticket. I will go back. Like,
that's funny.
But yeah. So.
Yeah, that was such a great game. And it's amazing because you can get up to a block away from Wrigley Field and still hear what's happening, which is part of the charm, I think, of the ballpark in general. We don't have to go deep into that. I think anybody who's taken the time to listen to us knows the charm of Wrigley Field.
I hope so.
That cool. I remember there was a game that I did, not to go way off on a tangent here before we talk about Adam Morgan and Zach Davies, but
right.
There was a game that I did where I was leaving because I didn't need to get any post-game quotes, and the game was close to over, and I actually was trying to beat the traffic because I had parked in the Cubs lot for media at the time, which was, I think, maybe two blocks north.
Yeah.
And so I'm walking and I'm listening. I'm following what's happening in the ninth inning because I think they're down by one. And, you know, I'm just trying to drive home to Springfield. So it's in the ninth inning. I'm following what's happening on Gamecast on my phone as I'm walking and hearing what happens like 10 seconds before my phone updates as I walk away from the ballpark. But yeah, that's just, you know, that, well, what a great memory. There's something different about being a Cubs fan, I think, especially with those kinds of memories. It just sticks with you. But
yeah,
but Adam Morgan, left-hander, he's I think 30 years old. They picked him up. I would say that this guy, he was a starter early in his career, didn't do too well as a reliever. He's been okay. Just pulling, if you want to look back to 2017, that's when he became a reliever full-time. 4.11 ERA in 146 and two-thirds innings, 4.18 FIP. He doesn't walk too many. He strikes out a decent amount. Doesn't give up a ton of hits, but it looks like he gives up almost 1.5 home runs per nine. So he gives up a decent amount of homers. But, you know, 158 strikeouts and 146 and two thirds. That's good, especially for a lefty reliever. I looked at his splits. He's very lefty. He's a loogie for sure. Yeah. Like that's his thing, is he gets beat up by right-handed pitching. And it's amazing that with the three batter rule being something relatively recent, that he wasn't better in like 2017 and 2018 when he could be used specifically as a loogie. But looking at 2017, he pitched 37 games and tossed 54 and two thirds innings, so he wasn't being used as a loogie then,
right?
So yeah, it for him to be successful with the Cubs, David Ross is gonna have to get interesting with when they use him. Maybe this is a pitch lab guy that they can do something with. Yeah, I at this point I trust Adam Morgan coming off of his bad 13 innings last year. I trust him at least every bit as much as I do Kyle Ryan to get lefties out.
Right. That's kind of what I figure too. I mean, since he's made the jump to a reliever from 2017, like his ERA is like just under 4, averaging like nearly three walks, and then like just under 10 Ks per nine inning. Like that's pretty good in about like 134, 135 innings of work. I'm doing the math in my head here quickly, but you know, like that's solid for a lefty reliever, especially when you were struggling to find one last year. Like that's a good guy to take a note on. I mean, he's a veteran. He does have the ability to dominate against lefties, and doesn't seem like he gives up a lot of home runs. I mean, last year he got annihilated with the 3 home runs in 13 innings. It looks like he gave up a home run in 25% of his at-bats, but our fly balls. But, you know, numbers are better. It's a good pickup, but it's nothing. I mean, we still have a lot of things to address.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need to hang on Adam Morgan too long, but
right.
I think if your theory is to build a bullpen by going out and grabbing these low-cost guys and stockpiling them and then working with them in the pitch lab or, you know, with the pitching coach and just seeing what you can fix, or even just finding a guy who had a down year and seeing if he can bounce back, if it's just that simple. I think this is a good pickup for that theory. And they've made that work to a degree even last year, you know, right, with Jeremy Jeffress, who got great results despite the fact that the process wasn't always great. This is a guy that I think you might be able to turn into a second reliever in your bullpen kind of guy.
Yeah, exactly. Like he could be a depth arm. Maybe as a veteran, you think you could do something more with him. But yeah, probably an arm to mess with. Tommy Hodovie has to mess in the pitch lab with, see if he can get something out of it.
Yeah.
Another pitcher the Cubs picked up, though, that we haven't really talked a lot about is Zach Davies. Obviously, he's the only major league player in the deal for Yu Darvish. And he's going to definitely be pitching this year for the Cubs. They're going to need some starters, obviously, now without Darvish, and looking like without John Lester, Jose Quintana, Tyler Chatwood, those guys don't seem to be coming back, at least in the fold for the moment. So the Cubs are going to have to lean internally. You wrote a good article about Davies for Cub Insider, I think on New Year's Day. What are you seeing from this guy that gives you at least some hope for maybe some success as a Cub?
I have to first tout the headline, which I mostly wrote myself, and it was, "Let's talk about new Cubs starter Zach Davies for a change."
Oh, and I see what you did.
Yeah. You see what I did there?
Yeah.
I first point out that he is not Kyle Davies, which is a comment.
I've read that a couple days ago. It was like, that's funny, because I've definitely made that mistake before.
The best part is this ran on Cubs Insider, and then I listened to The Rant Live, which is their podcast, which I recommend. It's also a web series with John and Evan. And it said they were talking about Kyle Davies. And I was like, oh, maybe they're talking about my article. You know, silly, vain me, thinking they're going to name drop me. They didn't. But John did call him Kyle Davies like 3 times. And Evan corrected him. So I thought that was great. But yeah, Zach Davies, I'm sure people listening have probably seen him pitch at least a couple times. The Cubs were his most frequent opponent in his career up until now. He's pitched against them, I think, 9 times and a bunch of times at Wrigley. He's had some success. He's most definitely Kyle Hendricks light. he throws maybe even a tad harder than Hendricks, consistently around 88, 89, whereas Hendricks, you know, frequently will be 86, 87. But he has a really good changeup. I noted in here that for his career, the changeup is definitely his best pitch. Mm-hmm. It's 41 at bats per home run on the changeup, which is good. The whiff percentage on the pitch in itself is basically 20%. So that is 20% is kind of like elite level. Hendricks, I noted in the article, is just a tick above him, Davies, on the whiff percentage on the changeup. And I also noted that in one of the charts I made, going back the last 3 years, the amount of usage on the changeup for Davies has really skyrocketed. And it's interesting. 2018, he only threw the changeup 12.5% of the time. Then 2019, 31%. And 2020, 41%. His ERA 2018, 4.77. Then 2019, 3.55. 2020, obviously only 12 starts, but 2.73. So as he's thrown more of his best pitch for outs, his ERA has gone way down. And also his strikeout percentage has gone from 17.5% in 2018 all the way to 22.8% in 2020. So he's figured something out, and he's having a lot of success in the way that Kyle Hendricks has. And I've seen quotes from Davies in the past where he's talked about, you know, he could probably throw a little harder if he wanted to, but, you know, he's basically ditched his four-seam fastball. He goes primarily sinker, and then changeup now. And for a sinker that moves, would you rather throw at 91, 92 and have it be mostly straight, or would you rather throw at 88, 89 and have a bit more movement on it? I think it's he's right in saying I'd rather throw at 88, 89 and have more movement. And I think Kyle Hendricks really subscribes to that same theory as well, and that's why he's been so successful. So yeah. I like it. I don't want to say I like the move, because obviously you traded Darvish.
Yeah,
this guy. And I don't really like that move, but I don't want to underrate this aspect of the deal, in that the Cubs, I think, are identifying some undervalued guys. This is a really good one to identify. I would have really loved a scenario where they kept Yu Darvish and traded a couple low-level prospects to get Zach Davies when the Padres made another move somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And just had an excess of pitchers that they needed to move one of them. I think that would have been a perfect move, lining up Darvish. You know, maybe you split up Hendricks and Davies just because of the pitching style. But, you know, having a 1-2-3 of Hendricks, Darvish, Davies would have been, I think, you know, take everything else out of it. That's a championship 1-2-3 for a starting rotation, in my opinion. Those three pitchers are good enough to win you a championship if you're going to go that route. So I really like him as a pitcher, and I think he's going to have a lot of success at Wrigley. He's on a one-year deal before he hits free agency. He's going to make around $8 million in arbitration. And depending on how well the Cubs do this year, I think you could see Davies get off to a really good start pitching at Wrigley with the wind blowing in, with the high grass, getting, you know, soft contact ground balls. I think you could see him jump out to a really great start and maybe be their Scott Feldman of this year, a guy that they move at the deadline. Although I think at this point, we'd all probably prefer that he, you know, pitch really well and the Cubs perform really well, and then you maybe invest in him being your number three or number four down the road as well.
Yeah, I like Davies, and I think it's interesting. I was reading through your article, and I like how you've pointed out that the Cubs maybe are trying to identify something more with these changeup throwing guys. Like, obviously, Alec Mills isn't nearly at the same level as Davies or Hendricks, but obviously, like you pointed out, he's got a 21% whiff rate on his changeup too, and nearly 120 innings pitched as a big leaguer now. Like, that's pretty good. That's nothing.
Really good.
Yeah.
I mean, that number, 21%, that's elite level.
Yeah.
You really can't, you know, the bulk of what Alec Mills has done came in a shortened season. Mm-hmm. And that we're talking about spread over the course of a career. Now, if he comes out and starts 32 games, throws 170 innings next year, and, you know, has a 21% whiff rate on his changeup again, I think we're talking about, hey, the Cubs have three of the best, legitimately three of the best changeups in the big leagues in their rotation. I also included an excerpt from a story that Matthew Trueblood wrote at Baseball Prospectus a year or so ago, where he talked about, rising use of the changeup and how there may be sort of a renaissance in that sense. So if he is correct about that, I think the Cubs are at the forefront of identifying the changeup as a really quality pitch if it's thrown well, and going out and getting those guys who have that success without having to throw 95-96 miles an hour on a fastball or a sinker.
Right, exactly. I think that's interesting, and it's a cool way to go and try and approach things, especially from the Cubs perspective, who have just they weren't getting any pitching, so might as well try and identify something maybe other people aren't quite as good at. It's an interesting approach, and it probably could have been something the Cubs maybe were just throwing against the wall and maybe it's sticking a little bit, but they've obviously been able to identify these guys who can execute this pitch well. And when that happens, it does make everything else work a little better. So I'm excited for it. It'll be fun to watch Davies and Hendricks go against each other. It's more of a bummer now that we don't have a Yu Darvish to stick in the front of them and think you've got maybe a real solid rotation, but Davies is a nice piece. He's never been a guy I was upset with. I mean, it was a bummer to face him sometimes and the Cubs just not do anything against him in Miller Park, but
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy that I think Cub fans got upset. Like, why can't they hit this soft tossing guy? What's the deal? Why is this offense so broken? Look at who's beating you. It's Zach Davies. But I'm sure that's how a lot of fans feel when they see Kyle Hendricks come in.
100%.
Hendricks isn't underrated by any means among Cubs fans, but I think he's very underrated among the baseball community at large, mostly because people look at strikeout numbers and they look at velocity, and that's how a lot of people measure who's good and who's not, which is a fallacy. But with Davies, and this is probably the last point I would want to make on it, and I think it's the most interesting number that you'll find in his splits, and it doesn't necessarily project anything going forward, but I just found it very interesting. Miller Park was his home park for the majority of his career. He pitched last year 12 games for the Padres, but in 61 starts at Miller Park, he has a 4.65 ERA, which is
it's not kind
of crazy.
Yeah,
it's bad. And Miller Park has been historically one of the more hitter-friendly ballparks, but when you think of pitchers, they typically do better at home. Hendricks is the example. Very extreme home and road splits, much better at Wrigley, not as good on the road. That's, Hendricks is a bit of an extreme, but it's much more common to find guys are more comfortable and pitch better in their home ballpark. If you look at Davies's career in every ballpark except Miller Park, for his career in 351 innings, he has a 2.95 ERA. I think that says a lot. I think that could be a very interesting stat, and it could say something about why they acquired him.
Yeah, that's definitely something I'm going to keep an eye on, because that's a huge plus. I mean, like, I know we were seeing that argument made a little bit with Tyler Chatwood when the Cubs signed him, and the idea was that he'd pitch much better away from Miller Park or from Coors Field, but to another beer. But obviously, if you have numbers from a guy who's pitched at Wrigley Field and he's got, I mean, you're talking about 351 career innings of 2.95 ERA baseball, that's pretty damn good. And pretty proven, I would say, at that point too. So that's definitely something we should stash in the back of our pockets for later, assuming the Cubs don't rip this team apart more so. But before we wrapped up though, Ryan, I did want to talk about, I know you were talking to me a little about this yesterday and wrote an article about this, but Derek Gould's Hall of Fame ballot was pretty weird. It seemed to include everyone you would think would raise an eyebrow, I guess, so to speak, from the Hall of, or from the steroid era, except Sammy Sosa. And your article tried to at least see if that could be made sense of, and it doesn't seem like that was as successful.
Yeah, and I want to start this by, caveating it the way I did in the story I wrote. This wasn't an attack on Gould, who I've met before at ball games, both in Chicago and St. Louis. He's always been a really great guy.
Super nice guy. Yeah.
He's very nice. He's very thoughtful. He's a genuine guy and a very good writer. So I don't write this story or talk about it here in a way to say, look at this St. Louis idiot. That because I'm sure he has his reasons for voting the way he did. It's just when I saw his ballot, I was like, you know, I know people make their argument. The people vote for Bonds and Clemens and not Sosa. I see it all the time. And the numbers bear that out. Bonds and Clemens are both above 70%, but below 75% as of right now on that Hall of Fame threshold. But Sosa's hovering around 23%. And I have to ask, like, why? How can you create an argument where you vote for Bonds and Clemens and not Sosa, where some of these other guys who appear on Gould's ballot, he also votes for, and he votes for Bobby Abreu, Todd Helton, and Curt Schilling as well. And any argument I think of for voting for Bonds and Clemens is kind of negated by voting for either Abreu, Helton, or Schilling. And so I kind of, you know, just try to bear that out and, you know, put out the points of, you know, okay, so if you're voting for Bonds and Clemens, you're at least saying that performance enhancing drugs are not enough on their own to say, I'm not going to vote for this guy.
Right.
But if you're not going to vote for Sosa, they have to mean something, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're voting for Abreu, Abreu's got very similar overall numbers to Sosa. I mean, if we're just talking about like OPS plus, they're exactly the same for their career. If we're talking about WAR, Sosa had 60.1 wins above replacement. Abreu had 59.8. So the big difference between them is home runs. Sosa 609, Abreu to 288. But if you just want to look at them as very similar players in a very similar in the same time period, if you're going to vote for Abreu, kind of have to vote for Sosa, unless you're not voting for him because of PEDs. So then you get into the whole, well, was Sosa a Hall of Famer before PEDs? No. Were Clemens and Bonds Hall of Famers before they started taking performance enhancing drugs? Maybe. But, you know, the evidence, we only know so much about when they started using steroids.
Right.
And we only know, you know, what they were caught with. And, you know, I don't think Clemens has ever even admitted that he was using it. He was accused of
perjury.
He was accused of perjury for basically the federal government said you sat in here in Congress and lied to us about using PEDs. Basically, for both of them, we can only go back as far as 1998 with what we think we know. But, you know, the case for Bonds. If he started using them in 1998, his numbers in 1999 and 2000 were very similar to the numbers of the few years prior. So do we really know when any of these guys started using it? We can make our assumptions,
right?
But do we, it's this hair splitting game of, well, they were a Hall of Famer before steroids. Well, what do you know about when they started using
it? Yeah.
Like
it's a bold assumption.
Yeah. And it's a bold assumption with Sosa as well, who I don't think there's any physical evidence that he ever used.
No.
I mean, other than, and I mentioned it in the story, other than the eye test. I mean, you can look at him and say
right.
He showed up in 1998 looking very different after a bad year in 97 where he was injured and didn't hit all that well. He was a good player before that, not a Hall of Famer. But, you know, he essentially transformed into a Hall of Fame hitter and hit that way from 98 through, let's say, 2002 or 2003 before he started declining. So it's just this, okay, so if you're going to say, okay, well, you know, Sosa's career was, his Hall of Fame thing was based on basically 5 years. And he was not a Hall of Famer other than that. Well, then you could start talking about Todd Helton. He had a 5-year period where he was just godlike at the plate. 2000 to 2004, 160 OPS plus, he hit 349 over the course of 5 years.
Wow.
That's insane.
Wow. 349. It's yeah. Like what?
But if you subtract out his 5-year run of dominance, which kind of runs parallel to the steroid era of Sosa and McGuire and Barry Bonds, I mean, at the same period of time, Helton's OPS plus is 117. Sorry, is 117 for the other 12 years of his career. Good, but not Hall of Fame level.
Yeah.
So why the scrutiny on Sosa but not on Helton, who is, you know, I'm not trying to say, I'm not casting doubt on him as maybe he used steroids. That's not at all what I'm saying. It's just the, I feel like there is some sort of double standard where people, I'm not accusing Derek Gould of this, but I do think that, you know, some of the Hall of Fame voters, they're finding reasons not to include Sosa, but they're not applying the same rules to all the other guys. And I also brought up the character clause that, you know, some voters like Phil Rogers don't really, you know, look at it at all.
Yeah, that's a way to put it.
But again, Gould voted for Schilling. So if you want to talk about guys with bad character, I think Schilling is way up there. So
yeah.
Clearly he's not looking at Sosa's character flaws and keeping him off. Because if you're going to keep Sosa off your ballot for character flaws, maybe you should look at Kurt Schilling's history of, you know, anti-trans, anti-Muslim,
yeah,
anti-journalists, lynch the journalists. You know, you could look at any of that stuff and say, oh boy, character flaws.
Yeah.
So I just don't. And again, this is not to attack Derek Gould. I don't encourage anybody to do that. But it does make me wonder, like, what's the thought process? And it's not just him. There's other people. I really want to know. And I'm not like a huge Hall of Fame guy. Like, I don't get riled up about Hall of Fame voting. I don't necessarily know whether I feel like Sosa should be in or not. When I look at it, I want it to be consistent. And when I see the disparity between Bonds and Clemens and Sosa, I feel like it's not consistent.
Yeah. that's about where I fall on the line too. I'm not going to be like losing my mind over a Hall of Fame vote, but I do think it's really interesting to see how many people, I mean, even just a couple of years ago, how many people were so against the steroid era, but have like kind of talked themselves into it as we've gone through and seen some of these guys, you know, stay on this ballot, hard to make these, you know, kind of exceptions for everyone. But it is weird how consistent everyone is very much against Sosa. And I think a lot of that also has to do with this, just that he's like pretty much an outcast from the Cubs, let alone baseball itself. It's such a weird situation to think, you know, like, and we talked about it a little bit when the Long Gone Summer documentary came out here, and we were disappointed there wasn't more Sosa, but I'm sure a lot of that had to do with the fact that Sosa's probably not offering too much access and he doesn't really want to talk about this, but I don't know. I hope things get figured out, and I personally would love to see Sosa on the ballot, especially if we're going to get allow Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens. I don't know if Jason Giambi's an option at all, but the guys like him, Rafael Palmeiro, those type of guys who were very clearly elite players during that steroid era. Those guys are going to come in here. It's going to be hard to not include Sosa, but it's getting close. I mean, he's getting close to not being included on the ballot much longer, correct? I mean, he's barely scaved off at the last couple of years, I think, right?
I don't know. I don't follow this as much as some people do. I thought the threshold to stay on the ballot was 5%. Is that right?
I thought it was 16%, but 5% sounds more right. I don't know.
You might be right. He's hovering at like 23%. So I think he's pretty safe if that's the correct metric of staying on. But
okay,
like, I don't think there's a year limit too. I know McGuire is not on the ballot anymore. McGuire never got any traction, much like Sosa, and probably for the same reasons. But it just seems like, you know, at the time that McGuire was basically falling off the ballot, Barry Bonds wasn't doing very well either.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually people have come around on Bonds and Clemens in a way that they're not coming around on Sosa. And, you know, if McGuire eventually 10, 15 years from now comes up on like the veterans committee, it wouldn't surprise me to see people put him in. I guess, you know, maybe it would. I don't know. It just seems like the Hall of Fame is so inconsistent with,
right,
you know, they set some rules for some people and, you know, they look past those rules for others. So like, I don't know. It just seems like if Sammy Sosa never took steroids, would he have been better or worse than Harold Baines? Probably around there. And Baines is in the Hall of Fame and doesn't really deserve to be. So it just seems like we're setting an unfair standard. And I think to some of your points, if Sosa had changed history a little bit, if he had been more forthright like others have, like McGuire, about his steroid use, if he had, you know, kind of been contrite and apologized, whether it's right or wrong, like the Cubs wanted him to, and was more embraced by the Cubs and was still bringing that energy as a player in a different role, as an ambassador, as a coach, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
If he wanted to do any of those things and did those things, I feel like the conversation around Sosa and his Hall of Fame candidacy and his legacy as a player would be completely different, because this is a guy in an elite club. He hit 609 home runs. I mean, that's insane. What is that, like number six all time somewhere around
there?
Yeah,
it's definitely, he was creeping towards the top five, but I don't believe he's there anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he was a very great player, whether you are offended by PEDs or not. You can't really deny the fact that over the course of a five-season run, he averaged 58 home runs a year. I mean, there was one person in the 60 home run club before he and McGuire got there, and then Sosa proceeded to hit 60 home runs, like, 3 out of 4 years.
Like,
I mean,
what in the world, man? Like, that's never going to happen again.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, this is a poor excuse in any aspect of your life, but when you look back at that era, the way everyone was mashing the ball, it was kind of one of those everybody's doing it. Nobody really faults the guys who tried to use steroids and then couldn't get their career off the ground after that. Like, if it didn't work for them, people just don't think about that. Everyone's going to focus on the guys that had great careers after starting to use steroids. And Sosa's kind of the poster boy for that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But anyway, wherever you fall on this side of the argument, I just hope that, we can have a clear and decisive conversation about how to treat this moving forward. And I don't think baseball's done a very good job about that.
No, they definitely haven't. And like you said, it's really tough to evaluate any of these decisions, because it feels like a different decision's made on a different player all the time, even if there's similar comps and a player that's in or not in. So just very arbitrary. And I don't know how you make it more streamlined, but at the same time, too, at the end of the day, I don't really care that much. Like, I think guys that had Hall of Fame careers deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, but I don't have a vote. I'm probably never going to have a vote. Who cares?
I don't ever want to have a vote. And I would say the vast majority of the people who do have a vote take it very seriously. You're going to have the occasional guys with the protest ballot, or the guy who... when you get into the Baseball Writers Association of America, you have to wait 10 years to vote on the Hall of Fame. So this guy got in and waited 10 years, staying in, paying his dues, being a part of the BBWAA, being a baseball writer. And when he finally got that vote, he turned in a blank ballot. And it's just like,
why?
I don't feel like people who do that stuff are taking it seriously. I think they're doing a protest ballot to draw attention. And yeah. Anyway, we're going off into Hall of Fame stuff. If it were me, I'd just say we're opening up a steroid era wing of the Hall of Fame, where anyone who was in this era can be put in here. And anyone who walks through this portion of the Hall of Fame is going to know that Major League Baseball looked the other way while these guys did what they did to make the game money. And what they did in the late 90s and early 2000s still reverberates through baseball today and how much money it makes. Because if you'll remember, the 94 strike did a lot to hurt, fans. The packed Wrigley that you see win or lose today didn't exist as recent as like the early 1998 season. Go ahead and go rewatch that Kerry Wood 20 strikeout game. There were empty seats all over that ballpark. Mm-hmm. So, this is an era of baseball that I think they, for the reasons we just talked about, they try and look the other way and pretend it didn't happen. They try and demonize the players while taking no responsibility. They don't give Hall of Fame voters much guidance on whether to consider steroid use as a no-go for voting for a player. So you get all these guys all over the map. Some people won't vote for Bonds and Clemens. Other people will vote for Bonds and Clemens, but for whatever reason decide Sosa is a bridge too far. So yeah, it'd just be nice if baseball would own up to its role in the past and make a clear way forward.
Yeah, that's all you really want, to be perfectly honest. Just let us know how you feel about it and we can figure it out from there. But the ambiguity of the whole situation is just kind of like what makes it so dumb, because then you do get people voting for weird and specific reasons that don't get applied to other players for other reasons, and it's just arbitrary at that point. But
now if we if we want to talk about a Hall of Fame snub, I think Jim Edmonds has a really good case.
Ooh, but Jim Edmonds is a guy that deserves to be on the Hall of Fame ballot, but that can
be a podcast for a different day. He is technically a former Cub, so
yeah, we can connect the dots here.
Before we get off the Jim Edmonds topic, yeah. The 2008 Cubs were like, yeah, I'm sure very big for you and your fandom, and it was big for me. You know, one of those first great years of my fandom that I really glammed onto. But like, when I go back and look at stats, like advanced stats we didn't have at the time, I discovered that Jim Edmonds by OPS plus was the best hitter on that 2008 team, and it about blew my mind.
He hit so many opposite field home runs that year. I just didn't understand.
He hit 19 homers in less than 300 plate appearances for the Cubs in 08.
Just nutso. Yeah, he stepped up every time, and you're just like, of course Jim Edmonds is going to hit a two-run shot today.
Right, like his OPS of 937 was the best he put up in any season going all the way back to 2004 with the Cardinals.
Wow. So
it wasn't his full year because he did start with the Padres and have a really, you know, really crappy start to the season with them, but yeah. Like that portion with the Cubs was as good as Jim Edmonds. I mean, not his best, but like they got a really good version of Jim Edmonds for that half a year.
Jim Edmonds, he
was absolutely their best hitter.
Everyone hated the deal until like he mashed against Milwaukee the first weekend the Cubs had him, and everyone was like, "Oh wait, Jim Edmonds, he's our favorite. This guy's our hero."
Yeah, I do think it's funny that everyone, as soon as that season was over, everyone's like, "Okay, screw it, screw Jim Edmonds again."
Yeah, so we all agree. Yeah, that's funny. All right, that will do it here for today's episode of Locked On Cubs. We appreciate you guys sticking around for a little bit of a longer one as Ryan and I dive into the Davies talk, Giambi signing, all that fun stuff. But keep an eye out for a couple more episodes this week. We are talking with Michael Ernst from Cubs Den later this week. He is a big prospects guy, and while I don't think there's a ton of guys that know any real tangible information about some of these prospects, if there was a guy on the Cubs side who would know something about some of these four young prospects the Cubs got back in this Yu Darvish deal, it'll be Michael Ernst. So he's going to be on the show later this week to kind of talk about what he sees from this system, what he's liking from the system coming up now currently, and some of these prospects that the Cubs just added from San Diego. So keep an eye out for that. But with that, you guys enjoy the rest of your day, and as always, go Cubs.